I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday.
Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it.
President Trump's new budget tells a very different story than candidate Trump told when he was running. The president released his budget yesterday, which calls for dramatic cuts to Medicaid over the next 10 years, plus reductions in programs that provide nutritional assistance and disability benefits. Today, Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me for the Midday Health Watch. We'll talk about the Trump budget from a public health perspective and how the president's priorities would impact Baltimore's poorest residents. Then, Grammy Award-winning violinist Hilary Hahn joins me in Studio A to talk about her latest projects and her extraordinary career. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Yesterday, President Trump issued a budget plan that proposes dramatic cuts to Medicaid and programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, often referred to as food stamps. Despite campaign promises to the contrary, the president wants to reduce Medicaid spending over 10 years by as much as $1.4 trillion, according to some estimates. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which provides health care support under Medicaid to low-income children, would be cut by 20% in the very first year alone. This, of course, comes after House Republicans passed a health care bill to replace the Affordable Care Act earlier this month. Some in the Senate have vowed to start over rather than work with the House bill as they craft their own in the upper chamber. If cuts along the lines that the president have proposed were to be passed into law, what would it mean for the most vulnerable folks living in our city who rely on programs like Medicaid and food stamps to survive? Today, it's the Midday Health Watch, our monthly visit with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. We're going to take a look at the Trump budget and the proposal on the Republican side to repeal and replace Obamacare through the lens of public health. Lena, always good to see you.
Nice to see you, Tom. Thank you.
So you wrote a piece that you published, I guess, yesterday on the health department blog about the kinds of groups of people that this would affect were this law to be passed. Mm-hmm. And of course, we should remind folks, this is a budget that is proposed by the president. The Congress will, obviously have a big say into what is finally passed when it comes to appropriating money. But you talk about seniors, you talk about children, you talk about folks with substance abuse issues. This is what's proposed by the president. Could have a really dramatic impact.
Sure. And the budget is the blueprint for a person's priorities, for a leader's priorities. And it is very concerning when we see that the proposal will harm the health and well-being of millions of Americans. And this is not hypothetical. I mean, I think a lot of times we talk about budgets and in terms of numbers, and these numbers seem staggering when we're talking about billions of dollars. But when we look at exactly who it will affect, in Baltimore City, for example, there are over 80,000 of our children who depend on Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program. I mean, this is how children get basic services like immunizations and treatment for their asthma. All that could be taken away if this proposal were to go through. Anyone with a chronic disease could be affected because they could be priced out of the ability to get health care. We could go back to a time that I remember very well of seeing my patients coming into the ER for conditions that were treatable and preventable. But now they're at a point of no return and people die from lack of health care. We have seniors in our city. We have about 100,000 older adults in our city, one in six of whom live below the poverty line and so also depend on Medicaid. I mean, we're talking about older adults who will no longer have access to prescription drugs and hearing aids and glasses, nursing home care. I mean, these are very basic services that it really is our duty as a society to provide. And I'm quite horrified, actually, at the prospect that this very basic level of services could be taken away and that safety net could be removed from those who need it the most.
The health department budget in the city of Baltimore, you get a lot of grants. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a big line item in the city budget, right? The city itself and taxpayer money going to support the health. You get a lot of grants and you benefit from federal programs. As you look at these budget proposals that the president has offered, what might that do to just, you know, fiscally, monetarily to your numbers?
Our Baltimore City Health Department budget is about $130 million a year. About 20%, less than 20% of it comes from city general funds. That means that over 80% comes from other sources and the federal government, including through federal grants that are pass-throughs to the state, are the large majority of our funding. So, for example, we have over 13,000 people in our city living with HIV/AIDS. We receive significant funding from the federal government to help to prevent HIV, to treat HIV, to connect people into services. That could be in jeopardy. We saw that there is a huge cut in the treatment for HIV in the president's budget. Chronic diseases, too. That's the number one, two, three killers here in Baltimore City and around the country. Heart disease, cancer, lung disease, diabetes. There's also a large proposal or the there's a large cut in the proposed budget to cut funding for treatment of these illnesses, too. In addition, we also depend on the federal government for assistance with disaster preparedness to prevent outbreaks, to investigate outbreaks and to prepare against natural disasters. That's our job. That's the core service of local health departments. And whenever we see, I mean, we saw the tragedy with what happened in England this week. I mean, protecting national security, protecting health and welfare is a big part of the work that we do on the local level. And it's fiscally irresponsible and also detrimental to national security when those safety net programs are being cut. And I worry about the ability that we have as the local health department in our local jurisdictions with the proposed budget. And again, it's not abstract to me. These are things that are facing our residents right now. And I'm very concerned about what this means to everyday people if this budget were to be enacted.
That's Dr. Lena Wen. She's the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a comment or a question for Dr. Wen, you can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can always follow us on Twitter, of course, at Midday Tom Hall. We are also streaming on Facebook Live these first couple of segments of today's show, thanks to our good friend Jamila Krempel, who is our Facebook Live broadcaster in chief. One of the things that proponents of this budget, Mick Mulvaney, the White House budget director, and several people in Congress have pointed to the fact that Medicaid will now, they're suggesting it be doled out in block grants to states as opposed to the other way that's been done now for quite a while, which is sort of take the number of people who need it and figure out how much per capita you need. What is the difference between the approach to allocating Medicaid funds from a public health perspective, to give a clump of money to the states or to allocate it based on the number of people who would be eligible?
I understand the principle of giving block grants to states. The idea is that it gives states flexibility. And I also believe that there are ways for us to improve Medicaid. I was on a national advisory panel to look at ways for us to improve Medicaid services. I mean, thinking about, for example, that health is not just about healthcare. Can Medicaid also pay for things like housing? Can we also invest in these other social determinants that make us sicker or healthy? There are ways for us to improve it, and giving autonomy to the states in and of itself is not a bad idea. The problem is that the block grants will not provide nearly enough for the states that are already struggling. And the last thing that we need is to take away essential services. I think about in Baltimore City, for example, that half of our pregnant women are dependent on Medicaid for their prenatal care. And as a pregnant woman myself, I can't imagine what would happen if I did not have access to prenatal care. I mean, what kind of services would I choose to forego? Would I choose my ultrasound and blood work that can keep this baby healthy? Or would I choose to pay for rent and food for the rest of my family? I mean, we know that women who do not get prenatal care are five times more likely to have babies who die. than women who do get prenatal care. And so when we look at the proposed savings, we also have to think that it's not just about the cost of an intervention. It's also about the cost of doing nothing. So when we look at these proposals that supposedly cut our costs in the short term, what are we doing in terms of passing the buck down the line? Are we going to be hurting generations of children, and how much is that going to cost? I mean, the proposed change to the ACA, the repeal and replacement plan for the ACA, as an example, it potentially takes away protections for essential health benefits, which means that things like maternity care may no longer be covered.
And what that means is that the federal government would no longer require states mm-hmm. to provide these essential health. They would have the option of doing it.
That's right.
I mean, in a real world, I mean, do you think lots of states, do you think the state of Maryland would choose to not cover essential benefits?
It depends on the fiscal situation in the state. And the requirement would also be waived for private insurers as well, who are beholden to stakeholders and may well choose to not pay for essential health benefits. I mean, this is what happened before the ACA, that people did not get essential health benefits. For example, things like emergency services and hospitalization. I mean, nobody plans to be
sick.
If
you're in a car accident.
That's right.
Or something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, nobody plans to get an illness. And so what happens if you do? You could go bankrupt, or you could decide to forego care and then end up having lifelong consequences. The proposal to repeal and replace the ACA also removes protection for those with pre-existing conditions. And so people can be priced out of healthcare. Out of any ability to get health care for things that many people have, like diabetes or cancer or asthma or even mental health and substance addiction, at a time when we're faced with an epidemic of opioid overdose, at a time when we are finally recognizing that mental health is just as important as physical health, the last thing that we need to do is to remove these core protections to allow people to get the treatment that they need.
When it comes to the cuts in Medicaid, let me ask you to give us a little economic primer here, even though you're a medical doctor, but you understand this stuff certainly much better than I do. The proponents of the current bill that passed, the health care bill that passed the Congress, and it's now being considered by the Senate, as well as proponents of the budget that the president suggested yesterday, are saying these are cuts to expansion in Medicaid. The CBO scored it at about $880 billion. There are others who say that in the current budget, there's another $60 to $70 billion that are added to that, bringing the total cost of this, you know, well above $1 trillion. But when we talk about cuts to expansion as opposed to cuts to Medicaid, is there a distinction? What does that mean?
Millions of Americans, including many people in Maryland, but all across the country, have gotten increased access to medical care as a result of Medicaid expansion. These are people who could now have all of that be taken away. I have people calling our office of the health department every day, worried about their insurance. These are individuals on Medicaid. They're also individuals on private insurance who simply have no idea about what's going to happen. And to put people's health in jeopardy like that is unconscionable and certainly is not good for the health and well-being of our country. I also want to mention that we all know, I mean, it's not just a medical issue, but I think we all know that prevention is the best medicine, that it's much better for us to prevent someone from getting heart disease in the first place than to wait until they have a heart attack to be able to treat them. It's much better to prevent someone from getting shot than to treat them once they get a gunshot wound. Prevention is also cheaper, and by cutting access to Medicaid, by cutting access to health insurance more generally, we're also hurting the ability of people to prevent illnesses, which will make it much more costly down the line.
We have a bunch of calls waiting. We're going to get to those after a break. But before we take that break, let me ask you one other question, and that has to do with this notion of the budget's reflection of capacity for compassion. Mick Mulvaney, the White House budget director, has spoken about this in the last 24 hours, saying that this budget shows compassion for the people paying for health care, for Medicaid, for other programs around the country. I mean, it represents, by a scoring by the New York Times, at about a 40% cut to non-military discretionary spending. So it's not just healthcare stuff, but other stuff as well. But what do you say to the people who say there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse? There's just a lot of people gaming the system. I mean, you're on the ground in the city of Baltimore, a city of 620,000 people, and you talk about the 100,000 seniors, mm-hmm. a sixth of whom are under the poverty line, 80,000 children who take advantage of Medicaid. What's your response to folks who say, you know, there are just all these people who are cheating the system, we're paying for all this stuff that is not necessary?
I would say that these people have not actually met the individuals whom I encounter every day. I meet people in our city who are working parents, who are struggling, and who are working multiple jobs just to get by. And these are the individuals who depend on Medicaid to provide care, very basic services like asthma treatment for their children. I mean, I myself, when I was growing up, required Medicaid, or else I wouldn't have gotten treatment for many of the conditions that I had, and who knows where I would be now. I would say also that these individuals who are making this argument about how there are people trying to game the system also need to take a look at, I mean, even forget the moral responsibility, which I think, you know, many of us do feel that we have a moral responsibility, a duty to help those who are the most vulnerable. We also just have to look at the fiscal responsibility that we have too, that prevention is a lot cheaper than treating illnesses down the line. And that this is ultimately protecting health and well-being is also an issue of national security too.
But from your perch as the city health commissioner, you're not concerned that there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse going on when it comes to the federal grant funding and federal tax dollars and local tax dollars that are being spent in your department to treat things like substance abuse, HIV, AIDS, malnutrition, access to health care in general.
We in Baltimore City make do with very little. We do a lot with very little, and so do my counterparts in public health across the country. I think that there are always ways for us to be more efficient, but placing the blame on people like our children, I mean, taking away services from 80,000 children because we think that there may be some fraud or abuse going on is unconscionable and is not based on evidence.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. We'll have more of the Midday Health Watch when we come back after a quick break. 410-662-8780. You can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back. It's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the City Health Commissioner here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. When it comes to choosing healthy foods, do we really know what to look for? A new study has found that most of us don't. We'll talk about what foods we should be eating and what to make of buzzwords on food labels like organic and gluten-free. That's all coming up tomorrow on Smart Nutrition here on Midday. As I mentioned, it's the Midday Health Watch today. Dr. Lena Nguyen is here. 410-662-8780 is how you can join our conversation on the phone. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones to Hagerstown. Brandon, welcome to the Health Watch with Dr. Nguyen.
Hey, good to be with you.
Thanks for your call.
So I guess my big problem with this whole thing is that I feel like there really aren't people taking advantage of the system. And that, just like the doctor said, if people were to really look, give a hard look at who's actually using the system, they come to find that for themselves. I'm 32 years old, and I have to use Medicaid because I was just recently diagnosed with a disorder called chronic variable immune deficiency. And you know what I was like before that? I was perfectly healthy. Ran 8 miles a day. I was on the crew team. I was fit. I was in shape. I took care of myself. And then suddenly, I'm sick. And it's something that you cannot get over. And I'm worried that with this bill, my coverage is going to be taken away totally.
Well, thank you for your call, Brandon, and sorry about your diagnosis. And Dr. Wynn, as you say, you don't plan to get sick. Again, proponents of this legislation say that they're happy about the fact that there are now work and training requirements attached to Medicaid, the way that they have been in recent years, in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, attached to, for example, welfare, the so-called welfare-to-work programs in the Clinton administration. What do you think about that? Was that a necessary thing? Again, this comes back to this notion that people are gaming the system. Somehow.
Sure, which is not what we're seeing on the ground in Baltimore City or across the country, and it is also not based on evidence and science. And I will say to Brandon's point that I hear stories like Brandon's all the time. Nobody plans on being sick. Nobody plans on being dependent on services that our government provides, but that's why the safety needs to be there. There's often this rhetoric of choice that we hear from those who wish to take away these services. But we have to remember that choice is predicated on privilege.
Here's an email from Daniel who asks, do states have legal ground to combat proposed Medicaid cuts? I mean, there are attorneys general, I'm sure, looking at this law, and I wonder if you anticipate legal challenges to the federal government saying, no, you can't cut these funds, or you can't give us a block grant that is insufficient to care for the people in our states.
Not being a lawyer, I'm not sure I can comment on this. I would hope that there will be legal challenges, just as there were many legal challenges to Obamacare itself. But I will say that so many of the proposals have huge impacts on states, including the states that will suffer the most, that also happen to be the states that's where its voters supported President Trump in the largest numbers. I mean, when we look at what could happen, including, we didn't talk about this, but the increase of cost insurance premiums particularly affect low-income older adults who could end up getting charged 5, 7, or even 10 or more times higher than people who are younger, therefore pricing them out of the ability to get health insurance. So we're really talking about everyone here. We're not just talking about who one might think of as someone, quote unquote, abusing the system. We're really thinking about anyone that we can imagine. I mean, children, older adults, anyone with any illness in any way or who can ever get sick.
And again, the idea behind charging older people more than charging younger people, if I understand it correctly, is that older people are in a better position to pay. That if you're a young person just starting in the workforce, you need incentives to buy health care to begin with because you're healthy. You're certainly not feeling like you're going to get sick anytime soon. As you get older, you realize that, you know, the bodies wear out in ways that you didn't have to deal with when you were in your 20s and 30s. But the assumption is that an older person in her 60s or even 70s is going to be better prepared to pay. But you're not finding that that's actually what's going on with, for example, the 100,000 seniors here in Baltimore City.
That's not what we're finding based on data. Our data show, from nonpartisan analyses, show that the individuals who are going to be the most adversely affected are low-income seniors. And this is also not how insurance is supposed to work. Insurance works when we all buy into the system, not just people who are older and already have many illnesses and then use a lot of services. Insurance works if we all buy in. And it's also the young people who may get sick too. And so having young people on insurance incentivizes them to use preventive services so that they prevent from getting sick later and then end up decreasing the cost for everyone.
Michelle in Bel Air, welcome to the Health Watch with Dr. Wynn.
Hi. I had a couple of statements or questions. The first statement is this administration is so, bent on having to build this wall between Mexico and the United States. And obviously Mexico is not paying for it, and so we're going to pay for it. All of that money can go back into social, I don't want to say social services, but just social care for the kids and the adults and everyone. It's just the management of money makes no sense to me. Taking away from kids and seniors and all the wonderful things that social medicine does or Medicare or Medicaid does. And I think a lot of that money's being funneled into building this wall, where I'm more afraid of Korea than the Mexicans that have been coming over for years.
And of course, many fewer people actually immigrating illegally now than there were just a few years ago. Thanks for your call, Michelle. You know, there is $1.4 billion in this budget that Mr. Trump proposed yesterday to begin constructing this wall. There's almost no talk about Mexico or anybody else paying for that now, as Michelle mentioned. There's a 10% increase in defense spending. And we've got people like Senator McCain, John McCain from Arizona, saying that that's inadequate, that we should have more on defense spending. So, you know, there really are hugely, just as the body politic is bifurcated in such severe ways, the approach to healthcare, the approach to public health, the understanding of whether or not healthcare is a right or a privilege is vastly different on either side of the aisle.
At the same time, we need to recognize that public health and public safety go hand in hand. That if we are not prepared, if what we care about ultimately is defending our country and protecting our citizens, we also have to be concerned about our ability to respond to outbreaks and to natural disasters. When I've heard arguments about the wall being about to reduce the supply of drugs, about drugs being trafficked in, and yes, that is important. Law enforcement is important for reducing the supply of drugs, but we also have to address the demand for drugs too. If there continue to be millions of people who do not get access to addiction treatment, then that's going to keep on fueling the supply of drugs too. So I think that the budget is a reflection of the priorities, but those priorities have to reflect reality and have to reflect data and science. And that argument of public safety and protecting the public also has to be tied back to public health and what we are doing as a society to protect everyone and deliver the core services that we expect as a country.
When it comes to formulating healthcare policy and allocating money, one of the things that strikes me is the specificity of each of these programs that are in the Trump budget, for example. There's a number for grants to states for Medicaid, which is down about 12% from previous years. There's a children's health insurance program, the CHIP program, which they actually state is 22% increase in this budget from previous increase. There's Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 27% decrease in their budget for next year. There are these very specific programs and departments and whatnot. Don't you fall into a position where you're having all of these worthy causes competing with each other? I mean, if we're going to, you know, have the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention competing for money and attention for insurance for children, I mean, that becomes a Sophie's choice on a daily basis, doesn't it?
But I think that that's the nature of a budget in any setting, whether it's the city's budget or state's or the federal budget. I mean, there is a finite amount, and we have to decide where will we have the biggest impact and what is it that we need to do. And I strongly believe that we as a country have a duty to protect everyone. We have to deliver a basic level of services for everyone and recognize, too, that health is not just about the health care that we provide. It's also about things, as you mentioned, Tom, earlier, of food stamps. We also have to have food access. We also have to have affordable housing. We also have to be looking at reducing poverty and improving access to work and job opportunities. I mean, all of that goes into health as well.
We have an email from Eileen who says there's been lots of talk about the opioid epidemic, and the government is so concerned that it's considered a crisis that has risen to the level of warranting emergency attention. And she says, I'm wondering why poverty and violence in the inner city are also not considered an emergency. And this is a point you and I have talked about many times. Leslie in Glen Arm is on the phone. Leslie, I think you have a question that's along a similar vein. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much. I do believe as healthcare advocates, we haven't done a great job in messaging about healthcare benefits being provided to individuals who are underserved and our society as a whole. And people don't even know sometimes that their employees or their neighbors are receiving benefits of WIC and SNAP and Medicaid. And I think that's part of what we should be doing as healthcare providers and advocates is letting people know, yes, this impacts your community. I am very, very concerned about the proposed changes in availability of health care, and I have been concerned for quite a while about the lack of adult dental benefits and the impact that has on communities, the impact it has on increased emergency department utilization, and the overall health of individuals and their ability to even manage caring for the children and those individuals in their care, because they can't access care for themselves regarding something that is so critical to maintaining our overall health. And just one other point, a couple of years ago during the disturbances in Baltimore, one of the newscasters, and it was brought to my attention through this newscast, is that when one of the pharmacies was burnt down, that was the primary source of groceries and nutrition for that community. I do not believe there is an awareness of the level of food deserts we have in rural, geographically isolated, and urban areas. I thank you, and I'll look forward to your comments.
Thanks for your call, Leslie. We've talked about the access to health care, but also access to something as basic as a decent grocery store.
That's right. And I've it's been a very humbling experience for me as a physician to learn that the health care that we provide is actually not what determines the length or quality of someone's life. So much of it depends on the other circumstances. I mean, I can tell a patient all I want that in order to treat their diabetes and heart disease that they have to eat healthier. But if she comes back to me and says, well, I have to take two buses and then walk 10 blocks to get healthy groceries, and then it's too expensive because the only thing I can get is Whole Foods, or if I go to the corner store, the closest thing I can get to a vegetable is a bag of potato chips. I mean, that's why that choice that we have is predicated on privilege and where someone lives, and the geography that we happen to be in, the zip code that someone happens to be in, determines someone's life more than the hospital care that they get. And so I absolutely agree with that. I also agree with the caller as well that we have to advocate for our patients. We have to advocate for those around us. And you know, and I would say in this case that there's a lot more that we have to do. We recognize that there's a lot in our current healthcare system that's not working. For example, access to dental health services, as she mentioned, is huge. Access to mental health services, also something that is hugely in need. But just because things aren't great the way that they are doesn't mean that we should roll back the gains that we've already made. Cutting health care to millions of people is not the right way to go. We should be building upon what we have, fixing the problems that exist, rather than rolling back the services and potentially costing thousands of lives.
We have a tweet from Dominique Maria Bonessi, who is on the WIPR news staff, asking about the federal government and their funds towards mental health and trauma screenings. What can you say about that? And what does this proposed ACHA, this repeal and replace of Obamacare, have to say about mental health in particular? This is a cohort of people that you're particularly concerned about.
I am concerned about it. And we know that there are several provisions in this budget, as well as in the repeal replacement plan for the ACA, that are concerning. For example, this budget would cut funding for the Community Mental Health Services Block Grants. This is a cut that could affect up to 70,000 Baltimore residents who receive publicly funded services for substance use disorders and mental health needs. In addition, we know that one in three people in our state who are receiving treatment for substance use and mental health depend on Medicaid. And so cutting Medicaid can also affect them. There's also something else that I want to mention, which is that people with mental health illness and people with substance use disorders as well can potentially be priced out of the ability to get health care because they will be considered to have a pre-existing condition. And especially if these pre-existing conditions are no longer considered part of the essential health benefits that have to be provided, that means that we could now have millions of people who are now receiving treatment go without access to care.
And what's your response to the Trump administration, the president himself, and others have said we're covered on pre-existing conditions? I mean, this was something that there were certain members of the Republican Party who were not behind Speaker Paul Ryan's bill, but they added, what was it, $8 billion or something to somehow address the notion of pre-existing conditions. They're contending that pre-existing conditions are taken care of, but you're not buying that argument.
It's just not true. The AHCA, the replacement plan, says that states can allow insurers to set much higher rates for patients who have a pre-existing condition, which means that they could essentially be priced out of it. I mean, I've seen patients who, yes, they can get insurance, but they have to pay $5,000 every month for it, and there's no way that they would be able to. The Republican plan has this concept of funding these high-risk pools. The problem is that you have to put a lot of money into these high-risk pools, and the amount that's currently available will not come even close to covering all of those with pre-existing conditions, which essentially means that millions of people are going to be cut out of the ability to get basic access to services.
Let me ask you about health disparities from neighborhood to neighborhood around our city. You've been studying this. You've been publishing it. You published a new thing called the Neighborhood Health Profiles, first time since 2011, I guess, was the last time that the department came up with the numbers. There is some reason for hope and optimism. There are some improvements between now and the last, 6 years ago. But there still are incredible disparities depending on where you happen to be born.
We have made strides in our city, and I think it's important to talk about the successes, because otherwise you look at these huge disparities and you think, well, there's nothing that we can do. But for example, we've reduced infant mortality in our city between 2009 and 2016 by nearly 40%. I mean, that's quite incredible, and it's something that we should celebrate, because it means that by working together through our coalition, Be More for Healthy Babies, that there are strides that we can do to protect our most vulnerable. But we continue to see huge disparities between neighborhoods. You can visit our website, health.baltimorecity.gov, and look up your own neighborhood. But you'll see that health also correlates with food access. It also correlates with violence. It also correlates with poverty. It also correlates with addiction. And that's why it's so important for us to invest in these core services now more than ever.
And finally, a personal question. We're following your pregnancy with great interest. You're in the second trimester. How are you feeling? You look terrific.
I appreciate it. I'm learning a lot. My husband and I continue to be very happy. And I'm following the news with great interest, because
and a new perspective, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. When I think about Zika, for example, this summer, and the impact of a Zika infection on the unborn child, I think about how my greatest wish, just like I'm sure for every pregnant woman, is to have a healthy child. And I want to do everything I can, which is also why reading the news about cuts to healthcare coverage is so difficult.
Well, it's good to see you. And we will, of course, see you next month, and we'll continue our conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, she's the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. She joins us every month for the Midday Health Watch. And we've got links to the Be More Healthy blog, where Dr. Nguyen often writes about public health issues. You can find it at WIPR.org/midday. Coming up next, Grammy Award-winning violinist Hilary Hahn joins me here in the studio. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stick around.